While it's not Spike Lee's final film, in many ways, I think his late or recent work, Black Klansman, could easily function as a final work, a sort of retrospective almost in terms of themes. It's a very different Spike Lee film, for sure, than, say, the films we think of as Spike Lee films from the outset of his career. But what strikes me about Black Klansman is that it reflects his growth as a filmmaker. I think that in terms of editing, pacing, the kind of acting performances he gets out of his folks on screen is really shows his maturity and development as a filmmaker, that with each decade, I think Spike Lee gets better and better at getting the very best out of the people he puts on screen. So there's certainly that element for me as when I think of, you know, how is Black Klansman something like a retrospective. It really shows where Spike Lee has developed as an artist in terms of the way he composes the screen and what he gets out of the people with whom he works. But it's also a retrospective for me in that I think it draws together so many of the overarching themes of his work, which are at some level about how to make cinema think and bear witness, which are two very different things, think and bear witness to the ontological status of anti-blackness. What I mean by the ontological status of anti-blackness is how anti-blackness is woven into our very being as a society, as a social, political culture. And that means that it comes out in terms of struggles that characters have within themselves, whether it's questions of colorism in school days, about transnational solidarity, or local fraternity politics, or class politics off campus in school days, all the way up through questions of how the police function, how groups of white people, whether they are, you know, the Klan, as in the case of Black Klansmen, or just simply white people in a black neighborhood like we have in Do the Right Thing or other films. The way all groups in those space, shared interracial spaces, are interpolated by anti-blackness. That is how their very being is organized by a specific form of hatred. That's all over Black Klansman. I think in the sense, in a couple of senses. One is it raises again this question of race and the police, which had come up in Get on the Bus very directly, but gets revisited here in Black Klansman, where the main character is a police officer and is black, and his sort of friend, becomes his girlfriend, is a black power advocate or activist at a college campus, and so there's, you know, all these questions that she puts to him, and it's put in a interrogative way, right? It's an open question across the film, although leaning very heavily in her direction of, can you really be on the side of black people and be a police officer at the same time? And that's a theme across his films, the way the police function. As I'd mentioned previously, and I want to talk thematically in a separate podcast piece about the function of the police across Spike Lee's cinema. The police typically in his films show up as radical outsiders who nonetheless set something in motion when they appear. You know, that's certainly Do the Right Thing is the peak of that, that the police show up. The first time they drive by the three men sitting talking on a street corner, they drive by and the whole film slows down, and there's a long stare that really embodies the suspicion and hatred that function between police and African Americans, or black Americans in this case, because there's also West Indians in the film. But So the police also show up, you know, I'm thinking also on Get on the Bus. When they get on the bus, it brings a certain kind of unity to the bus that it had been struggling with. That when the men were on the bus, it was all about their differences. But the second a white police officer in Tennessee shows up on the bus, Tennessee or Arkansas, I forget which, all of a sudden they become united, right? They come to identify themselves as a group under the gaze of the police. And so in Black Klansmen, there is an open question, right? It's a film around a book, and so it's not Spike Lee's creation of a black police officer and his relationship to David Duke and the Klan and the attempt to establish a Klan party or membership in Colorado Springs, Colorado. But it nevertheless poses that question across the film. What is the relationship both between the Klan and the police and between the main character and being a police officer, right? Him as a black person and the police. And of course, his relationship as a police officer, as a black police officer, to black power advocates. There's something interesting there as a sort of slippage. They are represented as a black power group. They have Kwame Ture show up to give a talk. But their politics around the police are much more like the Black Panther Party, which was not necessarily the same as the Black Power movement. But that's a maybe nitpicking a little bit too much. We also get a pickup of some themes in Black Klansmen. I'm thinking there's a conversation around the 1 hour, 4 minute mark. And the college student and the main character are talking about what films they like, right? And, you know, some films come up that have, you know, gangsters and pimps in them. And she says, you know, she says something to him about, you know, we need to move away from these movies. They're very damaging to black people, right? Even if they're made by us, with us in it, they nevertheless harm us, right? They do real damage. And that absolutely evokes the core thought in Bamboozled, which is that minstrelsy, right? That particular form of the degradation of black people is endemic, but also ontological, right? It's that out of which our being arises. And so resting ourselves free of minstrelsy is something that is a long historical process that requires awareness and assertiveness and consciousness of what we are both making and consuming. And this shows up, again, from a film from the early 1970s. And so for me, all of these things come together to make it really kind of a Spike Lee retrospective, right, of those kinds of themes. I think we could also see in the main character and some of his stuff around his relationship with his quasi-girlfriend, you know, whatever, courtship or however we want to put it. We see a little bit of his themes of masculinity and masculine identity formation. Although I think to Lee's credit, and I'm really happy about this, he really sets aside any questions of romantic interest and so forth in the film in order to focus on questions of the Klan, of the police, and this is the next point I want to make, the resonance of what was happening in this moment around the Klan and Colorado Springs and what was happening in 2016. With in the end credits when he shows footage from Charlottesville and the alt-right rally and everything that came from it. I'll talk more about that in a minute. But in the midst of all of this, right, where he is definitely evoking across the film the way the past is the present and the way the past being the present is still kind of our future, and the real pessimism that comes from that. I actually find Black Klansmen to be a funny film. I think the pacing and the acting and the cinematography and the art is fantastic. It's as good as Spike Lee has been in a fiction film. But it is absolutely one of his most pessimistic films. It's not quite to the level of Bamboozled, and I think it's interesting why it isn't. I think the only reason why it isn't is because you have armed militant activists and have some sense in Lee's, the sincerity of the activists in Black Klansmen, where that sincerity really was lacked by the Mau Maus in Bamboozled, that gives us not necessarily an exit ramp, but like a rope ladder, something really hard to walk across and really disorienting and dizzying to walk across, but nonetheless a transition from the past and present into a possible different future. And we can see that in the evocation of the sort of continuity across history in a couple of moments. One, there is around the 1:22 mark, hour 22 minute mark, where the Klan evoke the, or use this phrase that we are like the new Boston Tea Party. And in saying we're the new Boston Tea Party, it says something there about white conceptions of revolution, right, in the moment. That also resonates for those of us old enough, and I've found with my students, they have no real sense of the Tea Party as a party from the mid-90s, but in the early 2000s, they have no sense of that sort of roots in Newt Gingrich up through the revolt against Barack Obama, of this idea of a new Tea Party. But it's there also in Black Klansmen to evoke a continuity between our sort of Obama moment and the white right-wing reaction to his presidency, the relationship between that, between this moment in the early 70s and Black Klansmen, but also as this across history, that this is how white people approach any kind of racial change, any kind of change of the demographic makeup of who and what we are. Not too long after this conversation about the new Boston Tea Party, we're back in the company of activists, and we get a repetition of this phrase, and it happens across his films. I need to go back and document each instance where somebody says, "Wake up." That's, again, this moment where, for Spike Lee, he is able to signify something across his cinematic history. Going all the way back to School Days, his first really fully developed film. I always will say that it's a fully developed film. I always find She's Got to Have It to be sort of stunted growth. But School Days is his first fully realized film that ends with this notion of wake up that repeats all the way through Black Klansmen. And when he says wake up, the wake up, I think, resonates in two ways. One is the wake up and see what's happening. Three ways, right? There's a wake up and see what's happening, right? An assessment of the present. And there's also the wake up and see what's coming in the future, which is itself premised on, in terms of the temporality evoked in wake up, is premised on an understanding of the present, right? If the present is this new Boston Tea Party, is this way that even the culture being consumed, you know, pimps and gangsters, is anti-black, right? Made by four black people, right? It's still anti-black, and the white people are anti-black. What is our future, right? Wake up. We need to wake up and understand where we live now and how that has determined a trajectory of the future that, you know, ultimately can be altered. But along with that, right, there is a relationship the film wants to establish with the past. And as is typical in Spike Lee's films, he does this around an elderly character. In this case, a character played by Harry Belafonte. So in picking Belafonte, of course, he picks an immensely important person in the history of black activism, somebody who, like not all that many people, both has lived to be, you know, old and therefore sort of seasoned in his activism and perspective, but has also never given up his deeply critical orientation. And that doesn't always happen. A lot of people, you know, get conservative or moderate or just neutralize their radicalism in older age. But Belafonte hasn't, and so putting him in this film is also a way of saying, like, let's get an authority, right? A moral and political authority at the center of the film. I would say he's at the center of the film, even as he's a very minor character. And he's the center, a center of the film, because of this scene. It's around the 1 hour 33 minute mark, where he sits down with the college activists, the Black Student Union, I think it is, And he sits down to tell them about lynching, to tell them about racial terror. And if we do the math on it, it's really, you know, them learning about the sorts of stuff that their parents and grandparents would have a living memory of. But he doesn't just sit down. He sits down in this specific style of wicker chair that became famous in a photograph of Huey Newton. All right, we could just call it the Huey Newton chair. And that Huey Newton chair is like this moment where, you know, Newton in this iconic photograph is sort of pictured, he's pictured as like the king and the conqueror and the defender, right? And so there's something really interesting for me, the way Spike Lee puts Belafonte's character in this king, in this leader of resistance, in this militant chair, right? This chair that evokes militancy. And what he has for his militancy is a memory of lynching. I think that's really important because there's that moment that is so common among Spike Lee films where radicalism is not from, do I have the edgiest kind of politics? Am I a Pan-African communist, or, you know, however one would piece together some portrait of what, like, quote unquote, real radicalism looks like. I really like that Lee's version of radicalism, and agree or not agree is not my point here. It's just I find it so interesting and important that for him, radicalism is often just keeping the blunt and uncompromised memory of the past alive and in our awareness. So he does that with Belafonte by putting the moral and political center of the film in this evocation of the past of racial terror, which illuminates the present and future of racial terror, but that the memory itself is literally seated in militancy. It's seated in a space of militancy in the, what that chair evokes from its Huey Newton iconography, but also the radicalism of the students, that what they hear and what he's saying is a call to a certain kind of politics. And that for me is enormously important because it's his way, Lee's way of saying that sometimes remembering the past as it was for Black people is a form of radicalism that is absolutely transformative of our understanding of the present and our understanding of the future. And with that, I think it helps us make sense of the fast forward at the end of the film. Because at the end of the film, having outed these organizers of a Klan pod in a Ku Klux Klan pod in Colorado Springs and put them in prison and, you know, all of that. And the sort of police are celebrating this moment, and especially the main character Ron. And so, you know, they're celebrating it and they're sort of making fun of David Duke on the phone for having been duped by a Black person. And, you know, it's a funny scene and it feels poignant and all of that. But then as he goes in to sort of get his kudos from the police chief says, you know, we're going to dispense with all of the records from this case. We're going to basically erase it from our history as a police department and therefore as a region, as a city, right? We're not going to remember it. All the memory is going to fall on you, right? The people who lived through it. And that's why the book that it's based on is so important and why I think it's great that Lee made it into a film. Because this is something that really happened there and has no doubt happened in, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of places across this country where recorded memory, official recorded histories of these kinds of events are gone. Right, and what we have is memory, which when carried through oral traditions, never quite lands in the historical record the way it should. You know, I think it's part of our task as intellectuals to retrieve those moments of oral history and the way memory is passed down outside of what we think of as standard archival documents, and that way expanding our sense of the social, political, and cultural archive. That's just a part of what it means to do Black studies. But it's also important to get it wherever it can be placed in the historical record. And that's what the book does Absolutely. And that's what the film helps do. But in setting the kind of historical record moment straight, right, and leaving it there as part of now the cinematic supplement to what was a memoirist supplement to the historical archive, right, a memory piece inserted into that, we also have the transition that Lee concludes with in the film, which is the movement from this moment where the police want to bury and eliminate and erase from our memory and history the events in Colorado Springs. And that's immediately a transition into Charlottesville. And what happened in Charlottesville was all of that same Klan stuff, right? The Jews will not replace us. Literally was a chant. And it's so interesting to me teaching it this semester, this fall of 2022. My students remember Charlottesville. Some remember more than others. But even they were shocked to just hear how explicit and blunt the racism and anti-Semitism was among the demonstrators, and how clearly Spike Lee makes it a continuation of the Klan, right? But it's not just a continuation of the Klan in that these are anti-Semitic and anti-Black people, and Black Klansmen is about the anti-Semitism and anti-Blackness of the Klan at the same time. That's part of the story, right? One of the infiltrators is Jewish. But in making that continuity between what happened in the film and what happened at Charlottesville, it's about the continuation of these forms of organized white racism, right, that are out in the open. But also, and I think most importantly, the snippets from Donald Trump, who was saying, you know, this famous, like, there are good people on both sides, right? Good people on both sides. And he's been remembered for that, and I think sort of mocked for that. But there's something about seeing it in the context of this film that really brings home the viciousness and real, live, terrifying threat that that pronouncement, there are good people on both sides, what it initiated. Because what it initiated at, in terms of media representation and media treatment, what it was an attempt to initiate anyway, if it's successful or not, we can't know. But it was exactly the same thing that the police chief was doing, which was erasing the historical record by changing the story about what happened. In the case of the film, which is based on an historical event, it was erasing the historical record of police documentation by burning the documents or shredding the documents and replacing them. All that can replace them is memory, right? Memoir and film. In this moment where Trump is trying to do the same thing that the police officer did, right? Take the position of, you know, this stuff is wrong, but let's maybe wrong at some level. Let's bury it nevertheless. And then obscuring kind of rhetoric, right? So that now we talk about whether there are good and bad people on the left and the right, rather than the fact that this was organized Klan demonstration behavior, right? To the point of killing somebody and injuring tons of people in the midst of it, not in its aftermath, but in the midst of it. And so those end credits for me are, again, that moment where Spike Lee is thinking sort of prophetically, right? How do you critique the present in the name of a different future on the basis of a critical appropriation of the past, right? That sense of the prophet who speaks against the king, right? Speaks against the structure of power for a different kind of world. That prophetic moment, right, or structure of the film, is there when Harry Belafonte speaks, and it's there in the closing credits. And I think then in that closing credit sequence, Spike Lee is, in terms of just presenting through editing and integration into a larger cinematic event, is trying to do the same thing with cinematic language, what Harry Belafonte's character does with his own testimony to the horrors of lynching. And so that sense then of speaking the past, because the way time unfolds in the 21st century is really like 2016 and 2022 is kind of a distant past, right? It really has moved into the past, and it has to be kept alive somehow. And when it's kept alive, it's a radical act because it speaks what doesn't need to be articulated, right? It speaks anti-Black racism. It speaks anti-Semitism. It speaks Klan-based organized racism. It speaks it into the present because it's a representation. But it also presents what the past has been so that we stand wondering, right, what kind of other futures are possible. So I want to conclude then with exactly that question. Does Spike Lee tell us anything about what kind of future is possible, or even what it would mean to sustain that level of a question? I think that what sustains that level of a question, because I do think, like all of Spike Lee's very serious filmmaking, it ends at some level in the interrogative. I think the interrogative of this is in the dolly shot that actually transitions from the shredding of the documents and the credits in Charlottesville, which is this dolly shot, the sort of signature Spike Lee, you know, visual, where you know, the main character and his radical student girlfriend, or it's unclear if they're what's exactly their relationship is at the end of the film, but they have to answer the door. And at his place, they have to answer the door, and they both draw a gun, and the dolly draws us along with them. They're facing us. They're looking at us. The guns are pointing just below the camera or off to the side of the camera, and the dolly wheels them towards the door, and we don't know what happens next. But I think what we have to take away from the film in terms of what are we supposed to do with these evocations of the past, whether in Belafonte's character or in the footage from Charlottesville, what do we do with this, I think, is in that scene. And it's in that scene, in the way that scene is ambiguous. Are they there as self-defense? Are they there on the offense? Or are they simply figures of vigilance? Or are they all three at once? As you know, you might guess, I absolutely opt for all three at once. That one has to be vigilant about the repetition of the past in the present, and how that repetition of the past in the present, as part of our everyday life and so unremarkable or expected, is also folded into how we imagine the inevitability of this in the future. But also, in being vigilant about seeing that, it also is a preparation for both defense and offense, to defend radical thought, to defend Black liberation, but also that to defend Black liberation, one might have to be prepared for armed struggle, for violent struggle, whatever that struggle is. Because as the footage from Charlottesville shows, and as the entire trajectory of the Klan in Colorado Springs, in the body of Black Klan, the film Black Klansman shows, right, the right wing has absolutely come with violence. They're here for violence. And so what vigilance means is seeing that violence. What defense and offense mean are being prepared to know and knowing what meeting that violence looks like. And what it looks like cinematically is that dolly shot. It's the way we are being dragged along. We don't push ourselves into this. We being people who believe in Black liberation and some radical transformation of society, which Black liberation would mean that radical transformation, that we don't drive towards that violence, that white violence. We are drawn to it, but we can be drawn to it in the mode of surprise or in the mode of vigilance, defense, and capacity to defeat it. In that way, I think Black Klansman, for all of its accomplishments visually and narratively, is a moment where Spike Lee opens upon a different kind of militarism around Black liberation than he has in his other films. Exactly in that moment where, what does it mean to meet your enemy? It means to meet your enemy with guns drawn.